no two tuned to the same channel. One choice was an old black-and-white gangster movie with lots of guys in fedoras toting Tommy guns. Option two was a boxing match. And three was a night baseball game, probably being played in the Midwest. Rounding out the selection was a home improvement show, in case you were unsure how to use a miter box. Marvin stood at the bar, where guys were layered too deep, crowded against the knees of drinkers who'd staked out the black leather bar stools. Marvin wore charcoal dress pants and a sport coat over an open-collared polo shirt. He had a martini glass in one hand, and in his other, a lighted cigarette. His gaze flicked to me, veered off, and returned. He smiled and raised his glass.
"Hey, guys, look who's here. This is that private detective I was telling you about."
His coterie of stalwart drinkers turned as one, five pairs of eyes fixed on mine, some more focused than others. There were introductions all around. I made a quick study of the women, easy since there were only two of them. Geneva Beecham was in her late 50s, heavy-set, with shoulder-length gray hair, bangs cut severely across her forehead. The other woman, Earldine Rothenberger, was tall, thin, and round-shouldered, with a long neck, slightly undercut chin, and a nose that might have benefited from the gentle adjustments of a plastic surgeon. I had to chide myself. These days, when so many women have undergone correction, refinement, and reconstruction, you have to admire those who accept what they were given at birth. The men were more difficult to sort out, primarily because there were four of them, and the names came so rapidly I hardly had time to separate them. Clyde Leffler, to my immediate left, was clean-shaven with a sparse gray pompadour, bony shoulders, and a sunken chest, accentuated by a green V-neck acrylic sweater, which he wore with jeans and running shoes. Buster somebody, his physical opposite, had a big chest, heavy arms, and a bushy black mustache. The third fellow, Doyle North, had probably been handsome in his 20s, but he hadn't aged well. The fourth fellow of the sixum had gone off to see a man about a dog. He'd be back shortly, and Marvin said he'd introduce him. I said, "Don't worry about it. I'm never going to remember who's who anyway." I leaned closer to Marvin so I could make myself heard. "I didn't know you smoked."
"I don't, except occasionally when I drink. Speaking of which, can I buy you one?"
"No, thanks. I'm a working girl. I have to keep my wits about me."
"Come on, a little something, a glass of white wine?"
I declined, but the words were lost in a momentary outcry of excitement and dismay. I looked up in time to catch a replay of the last few seconds of a prize fight, in which one fellow hit the other so hard you could see his jaw dislocate. Marvin was already inching toward the waitress who was picking up a tray of drinks at the far end of the bar. I saw him lean in and say something, to which he nodded before heading to a table. Marvin made his way back, holding his drink aloft to avoid an errant elbow knocking into it. His cigarette he also held above the fray, lest he sear small holes in the clothing of those he sidled past. When he reached me, he gave the bartender the high sign, and I watched the man amble over to our end of the bar. Raising his voice, Marvin said,
"This is Ollie Hatch. He owns the place. Ollie, this is Kinsey. Anything she wants, she gets."
"My pleasure," Ollie said.
He reached across the bar and the two of us shook hands. Marvin turned to me. "You have business cards?"
"I do."
I searched the depths of my shoulder bag and came up with a little metal case in which I carry my cards. I gave him six and he held them up saying,
"Listen, gang. You think of anything that might be useful, Ollie's got a bunch of Kinsey's cards. She'd appreciate any help she can get."
This did not generate an outpouring of pertinent information, but perhaps the timing was off. He passed the cards across the bar to the owner and then took my arm and steered us to one side. The noise level made it impossible to converse. If he lifted his voice and I tilted my head, I could still pick up only disjointed portions of what he said.
"Apologize again for that business with the newspaper gal. Guess I got carried away."
"She set you up."
She's done it to me, too.
Say again?
Marvin put a finger behind the flange of one ear, pressing the rim forward as though to capture more sound. I was about to raise my voice and repeat myself when I decided what I'd said wasn't worth the effort. I pointed at the door, and he pointed quizzically at his chest. I nodded and moved toward the exit with Marvin close behind. I more or less fell through the open door. The fresh air was so chill and clean, it felt like I'd stepped into a refrigerator. The noise level dropped to a blessed hush. I said, "I don't know how you stand it in there. You can't hear a thing."
"You get used to it. Crazy bunch. We call the place the Hatch. We're hatchlings. Most of them have been coming here for years. Place is open 7 days a week. Tonight was rowdy for some reason. Lots of times it's dead. You take it as it comes."
He glanced down.
"Hey now, the waitress never brought your drink. Hang on and let me see if I can catch her. I'm not here to drink. I'm hoping to pick up the key to Audrey's house in San Luis. I've got time in the morning to make the round trip drive."
"Yeah, well, that's just it. I don't have a key. All I have is the address, which I don't remember offhand. You have a minute to stop by. I live a block from here."
"I don't want you cutting your evening short."
"Don't worry about it. I'm here 3-4 nights a week as it is, so it's not like I'm in danger of missing anything fun."
"Such as what?" I asked.
"Oh, you know, sometimes Earl Dean topples backward off her bar stool, but she usually doesn't hurt herself. You have a car?"
"Parked around the corner. Don't you want to settle your bill first?"
"Nah, I keep a running tab and pay at the end of the month."
We walked the half block to my car, and I ferried him from there to his house, which was literally one block away. I parked out front and followed him up the walk, waiting while he sorted through his ring of keys and unlocked the front door. He reached around the frame and switched on the overhead lights. He went in first and made a quick circuit to the living room, turning on table lamps. The living room and dining L were both tidy, and there was no reason to believe the rest of the house was any different. I said, "So tidy."
"Place was a mess before Audrey moved in. She talked me into a cleaning lady, which I never bothered with. I figured it was me on my own, and what difference did it make? She set me straight on that score."
"Women tend to do that."
"Not my wife. Margaret wasn't much of a housekeeper. She was more the creative type. She was a daydreamer. Most of the time she walked around in a fog. She just didn't see the chaos. She saw what she meant to do with it, but hadn't gotten around to yet. Kitchen looked like a bomb hit it. But in her mind's eye, she was getting everything under control. Company showed up, she'd shove dirty dishes and all the bric-a-brac in the oven to get it out of sight. Then she'd forget and preheat the oven, and the place would fill with smoke, and the alarm would go off. What did I know? My mother was the same way, so I thought that was normal."
While he talked, he crossed to a small roll-top desk and opened the middle drawer in a bank of cubbyholes. He took out a notepad and leafed through it until he found what he was looking for.
"Address is 805 Wood Lane. A piece of mail showed up here for her, and I made a note. I guess in case I wanted to send flowers or something."
What a laugh.
He ripped off the leaf and handed it to me. "Audrey mentioned her landlady lived right next door, so maybe you can get a key from her."
"Worth a try," I said. "Something I need to ask you. I have a friend who's a cop. He told me Audrey's body was still at the coroner's office. So what was with the coffin if she wasn't in there?"
"Mr. Sharonson provided one if I promised to have her buried in it once the body was released. It just seemed fitting, you know? Someone dies, you have a visitation. You think that was bad?"
"Of course not. It just took me by surprise.
Sorry if it seemed dishonest. I wanted to do right by her."
"I understand," I said. "While I'm here, would you mind my taking a look at her things?"
"You can do that, sure. Doesn't amount to much. The desk was hers. My office is in the second bedroom. I cleared two drawers of a chest of drawers in the master. In the bathroom, she's got the usual shampoo, deodorant, that kind of thing.
Let's start there.
You want me to hang around or make myself scarce?
Come with me. That way, if anything comes up, I can ask questions while I search.
He showed me into the bathroom off the master bedroom. Margaret and I remodeled 15 years ago, tore out a wall here and opened these two bedrooms to form a master suite. Doesn't look like much compared to new houses these days, but we were happy. We did a bump out in the kitchen to make like a breakfast nook, and then added a screened-in porch. I made what I hoped were appropriate responses while I sorted through the medicine cabinet and the vanity drawers she'd been allotted. He was right about her medications. No prescriptions at all. 63 years old. You'd think she'd be into hormone replacement therapy or thyroid medication, pills for high blood pressure or elevated cholesterol levels. Her personal hygiene products were just what you'd expect. Nothing exotic. I'd have been happy to see a tube of Mary Kay lipstick just for the chance to track it back to the local rep. The police still have her purse, he said, apropos of nothing. Doesn't surprise me. Too bad she didn't take prescription meds. We might have tracked down her doctor and learned a thing or two. When he saw that I'd run out of drawers to tackle, he said, "Bedroom's this way." I followed him into the bedroom where he pointed out the drawers she used. When I opened the first, I was greeted by a soft cloud of fragrance. Lilac, gardenia, and something else. Marvin took a step back.
Whoa!
What? That's the white shoulders I gave her on our six-month anniversary. It was like her signature perfume. He shook his head once, and his eyes flooded with tears. Are you okay? He gave his eyes a quick swipe. Took me by surprise, is all. You can wait for me in the other room if it's easier. No need. I went back to my search. Audrey's tidiness extended to her lingerie. In both drawers, she was using fabric-covered boxes to store her neatly folded underpants, bras, and pantyhose. I felt my way through the items without discovering anything. I pulled the drawers all the way out and checked for papers or other items taped under them or on the back. Zip. I crossed to the closet and opened the door. There were rods for double hanging, cubby holes, shelf dividers, wire baskets, and cedar-lined shelves tucked away behind clear lucite doors. Her wardrobe struck me as skimpy for a working woman. Two suits, two skirts, and a jacket. Of course, this was California, and work clothes were more casual and relaxed than in other places. Marvin's side of the closet was as organized as hers. I said, "You guys are something else. She must have had a closet company come in and do this." Matter of fact, she did. I removed stacks of folded sweaters, felt along the seams for anything hidden. I checked the pockets in her slacks and jackets, opened shoe boxes, and rooted through the laundry hamper. There was nothing of interest. I returned to the small desk in the living room, where I sat down and worked my way through the drawers he'd cleared for her. No address book, no month-at-a-glance calendar, no appointment book. It was possible her route was preset and she had no need to make penciled reminders to herself. But what about the ordinary day-to-day transactions? Everyone has to-do lists, scraps of paper, scratch pads with scribbled notes. There was none of that here. Which meant what? If Audrey had decided to kill herself, she might have systematically deleted anything of a personal nature. I wasn't sure why she'd be that secretive. Unless she was paranoid about anything connected to her shoplifting extravaganzas. She'd been working with a younger woman. If the two were linked to a larger retail theft ring, even a fragment of information might be telling. So maybe the other woman was the one who kept track of their activities. The flip side of the issue was just as troubling. What if she hadn't killed herself? If she'd been murdered, she probably didn't have warning. And therefore, she'd have had no opportunity to erase personal or professional references. Did she tidy up after herself as she went along? I had to credit her with a job well done. So far, she was invisible,
I sat in her desk chair and pondered the situation. Marvin had been good about keeping his comments to a minimum. I turned and looked at him. When it came to business travel, what was the pattern? She was usually gone 3 days a week. The same 3 days, or did it vary? It was pretty much the same. She'd be gone Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and every other Saturday. With outside sales, you usually have a regular route for customers you visit or stores you service. Plus, you make a certain number of cold calls, developing new contacts. Was she in town last Friday when she was ordinarily gone? I have no idea. She said she'd be away the usual 3 days. She worked from home on Monday and Tuesday and then took off, saying she'd be back first thing Saturday morning. In time for her regular hair appointment. Right. That and the real estate agent. I changed my focus. Did she have hobbies? It may sound irrelevant, but I'm looking for any kind of crack in the wall. No hobbies. No exercise program, no sports, and she didn't cook. She used to make jokes about what a rube she was in the kitchen. If I didn't do the cooking myself, we went to restaurants, did takeout, or ordered in. She liked anything that could be delivered. Lots of times we ate at the Hatch, which has a limited menu of bar food. Burgers and fries, nachos, chili, and those pre-made burritos you can heat in the microwave. I was already thinking about whizzing back over to the Hatch to catch a bite to eat before the kitchen closed for the night. I returned my focus to the job at hand. Where did she do her banking? No idea. I never saw her write a check. Did she cover her share of the living expenses? Sure, but she paid me in cash. No checking account? Not as far as I know. She might have had a checkbook in her purse, but the cops still have that, and I doubt they'd provide us an inventory. Did she pitch in on groceries? When she was in town. I covered the household because my name's on the mortgage, and I have to pay water and electric whether she's here or not. What about when you went out to dinner? I'm old school. I don't believe a lady should pay. If I invited her for a meal, it was my treat. Did she explain her reliance on cash? Seems quirky to me. She said she got into debt at one point, overdrawing her account, and the only way she could curb her spending was to switch to all cash. What about credit card statements? No cards. Not even a credit card for gas when she was on the road? Not that I ever saw. How about telephone bills? Surely she made business calls on days she worked from home. He considered the question. You're right. I should have thought of that myself. I'll pull the phone bills for the months she was living here and mark any numbers I don't recognize. Don't worry about it until I've checked the house in San Luis. That might be a gold mine of information. Anything else I can be doing? You could put a notice in the newspapers. The Dispatch, the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Luis Obispo Tribune, and the Chicago papers. Seeking information about Audrey Vance. Use my phone number in case we get crank calls, which are all too common in these situations. And if no one comes forward, well, if the house in San Luis doesn't net more than this, I'd say we were up shit creek. But overall, this is good, right? I mean, so far, you haven't uncovered any evidence she was a master criminal. Funny you should say that. I forgot to mention my talk with the vice detective. Audrey's been convicted of grand theft on at least 5 prior occasions, which suggests she was into retail theft up to her pretty little neck. Saints preserve us, he said, which was a phrase I hadn't heard in years. Chapter 13. The drive from Santa Teresa to San Luis Obispo took an hour and 45 minutes. I was on the road by 8 a.m., which put me in SLO at 9:45 on the nose. The late April weather was sunny and cool, with a breeze blowing flirtatiously through the trees along the side of the road. Traffic was light. The winter months had generated sufficient rainfall to transform the low rolling hills from the usual honey and gold hues to a vibrant green. San Luis Obispo is the county seat, the home of Mission San Luis Obispo de Tolosa, the fifth in the string of 21 missions that dot the California coast, from San Diego de Alcala to the southernmost point, to San Francisco Solana de Sonoma to the north. The charm of the town was completely lost on me. I'm single-minded when it comes to the hunt, and I was interested in what I might find in Audrey's house. The fact that I didn't have a key in my possession only added to the fun. Maybe I'd have the opportunity to use the key picks Pinky had given me. I left the 101 at Marsh Street, cleared the off-ramp, and pulled over to the curb. I tossed a city map on the passenger seat beside me, and now I spent a few minutes getting my bearings. I was looking for Wood Lane, which the street index indicated was somewhere on the grid designated as J8. I followed the coordinates, taking the dogleg from Marsh to Broad Street, one of the main arteries through town. Closer to the airport in the southeastern section of the city, Broad became Edna Road. Wood Lane was an offshoot as delicate as an eyelash and just about that long. The area was mixed use, industrial and agricultural. I could imagine a city planner or a developer many years before with vision enough to realize the land would be more valuable vacant than given over to subdivisions. A few single-family dwellings had cropped up in what was otherwise a flat countryside. Aside from the fields under cultivation for spring planting, the landscape was hard-packed dirt, sparse vegetation, and the occasional fence. Here and there I could see an outcropping of boulders as big as sandstone sedans. In the absence of trees, the wind swept across the bare acreage, throwing up eddies of dust. Wood Lane was a cul-de-sac with two small frame houses at the end. The ranch-style house on the right was set in the middle of a well-kept lawn. The driveway was blacktopped and lined with white stones. The address there was 803, which I took to be her landlady's house. Audrey's driveway consisted of two dirt ruts with a stretch of dead grass between. At the end of the drive, there was a single-car garage with a small shed attached. I parked and picked my way down the rough drive, taking note of the overgrown shrubs surrounding the house on three sides. The overhead garage door looked ancient, but it yielded without a fuss. The interior was empty and smelled of hot dust. The floor was concrete, marked by a black patch in the center, where a vehicle had leaked oil. I leaned down and touched the surface of the spill, which was still sticky. The adjacent shed contained two bags of bark mulch the rats had chewed through. I returned to the front porch and climbed the stairs. The white paint on the one-story cottage had turned chalky with age. The windows sported injured-looking Venetian blinds, hanging crookedly from their mounts. A mailbox was nailed to one side of the front door. I did a quick check and came up with two pieces of mail, both addressed to Audrey Vance. As she was dead and I was unobserved, I opened both envelopes. The first was a pre-approved credit card offer from a company that looked forward to serving her financial needs. The second was a response to an inquiry about rental property in Perdido, 25 miles to the south of us in Santa Teresa. It was a form letter she'd sent in response to an application she'd filled out, in which she'd neglected to complete certain items that were required for proper processing. There followed several X's in parentheses, indicating that she needed to supply the address and telephone number of her employer, her job title, and the number of years in that position. Also, the name and contact number for her current landlord, along with her reasons for leaving. Regretfully, we have nothing available at this time. We have, however, placed your letter in our files, and if at any point in the future one of our tenants should give notice, we'll be happy to get in touch. I shoved the two letters into the outer compartment of my shoulder bag. The credit card offer I'd toss at the first opportunity. The form letter from the property management company I'd look at again. It was possible that on further reflection, I'd see a way to make use of it, though I wasn't quite sure how, which left me with the physical premises. On the off chance the door was unlocked, I tried the knob. Nope. While I was at it, I went around to the rear and tried the back door with the same result. I returned to the front yard and studied the sparsely traveled road. Audrey was a party animal, yet here she was, miles from the nearest bar and the nearest convenience store. What was the point? If she'd needed to spend two nights a month in San Luis Obispo, why not camp out at the nearest Motel 6? I couldn't imagine why she'd elect to rent such an isolated place, unless she was up to no good. I looked over at the house next door, which was separated from Audrey's by a sagging wire fence. Everything in Audrey's yard was dead, but I could see signs of a newly planted garden on the neighbor's side of the fence. Behind the house, a woman with a laundry basket was pinning freshly washed linens on the clothesline. The sheets flapped and snapped, sounding like the beating of wings as they tossed in the wind. I crossed to the fence and waited to catch her eye. She was in her 40s, wearing a cotton house dress with an apron over it. Her bare legs were sturdy, and the muscles in her arms had been defined by hard work. When she noticed me, I waved and gestured her closer. She put a handful of clothespins in her apron pocket and approached the fence. Are you looking for Audrey? Not exactly. I don't know if you're aware of it, but she died this past Sunday. I was about to say the same thing to you. I read about it in the local paper. You're her landlady? She rented the house from my husband and me, she said with caution. I'm Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private detective. I reached into my shoulder bag and extracted a business card, which I passed to her. I could see her taking the information at a glance. She said, Vivian Hewitt, I thought you might be the police. Not me. Audrey was engaged to a friend of mine. Questions have come up in the wake of her death, and he's hired me to fill in the blanks. Questions of what sort? For one thing, she told him she had two grown kids living in San Francisco. He has no way to reach them. If nothing else, he'd like to let them know what happened. He thought she might have kept an address book up here among her personal effects. I can understand his concern. Is there something else? Basically, he's wondering how big a fool he was. Some of what she told him turns out to be false. She also omitted a couple of crucial details. Such as what? She'd been convicted of grand theft and served time in prison. Grand theft means she was picked up with merchandise worth more than $400. 6 months ago, she finally got off parole. Then, Friday of last week, she was arrested again. We hoped you'd be willing to open the house so I can have a look. You're welcome to accompany me if you're worried this isn't on the up and up. She studied me briefly. Wait here and I'll fetch the key. I returned to the front porch and tried peering in the windows while Vivian Hewitt was gone. The slats in the Venetian blinds were set, so all I saw were thin slices of floor. Not that informative as these things go. A few minutes later, she returned with a big ring of keys. I watched her sort through the collection until she found one marked with a dot of red nail polish. She inserted it in the lock. The key refused to turn. Frowning, she pulled the key from the lock and tried it again. Well, I don't know what's wrong. This is a duplicate of the one I gave her. Mind if I have a look? She handed me the key. I checked the manufacturer's stamp and then leaned forward and examined the lock itself. This says Schlage. The key is a national. She changed the locks? She must have. Well, she never said a word to me. Audrey's full of surprises. I have ways of getting us in there if you don't object. I don't want my windows broken or the door kicked down. Absolutely not. We circled the house to the rear and tried the same key again. Not surprisingly, that lock had been swapped out as well. You have a problem with my picking this? Help yourself. I've never seen it done. I took out my trusty leather zip case and removed the custom-made picks Pinky Ford had fashioned for me. Pinky had confessed that he sometimes constructed picks with complicated-looking bends and twists, when in reality, the only two items required were a tensioned wrench and a length of flat wire, bent at the tip. A bobby pin or a paper clip would do the same job. I removed the tension wrench from the case and inserted it into the lock, applying a gentle pressure while I eased the fielder pick to the back of the lock. The trick was to wiggle the pick as I pulled it out, easing it past the pins. With luck, the pick would toggle each pin in turn until it cleared the shear line. Once all the pins were up, the lock would pop open as though of its own accord. I have an electric lock pick that does the job in half the time, but I usually don't have it with me. It's a felony offense if you're caught carrying burglar tools. During my initial instruction, Pinky had dismantled a number of different lock mechanisms to demonstrate the technique. After that, he said it was a matter of developing the proper touch, which differed from person to person. Like any other skill, practice made perfect. There was a period when I was adept, but it had been a while since I'd had occasion to pick a lock, so the task required patience. Vivian watched with interest, and I wouldn't have put it past her to try it herself once I was gone. 1 minute became two, and just when I was about to despair, the pins gave way. The door swung inward, and we were at liberty to tour the place. "That was handy," she remarked. "You bet. In a circumstance such as this, I like to be systematic, starting at the front door and working my way back." Vivian was a step behind me as I turned to survey the space. "Have you been here recently?" "Not since she moved in." The interior was a simple box, divided into four squares, living room, kitchen, bedroom, and a combination mudroom, bath, and laundry room. The living room contained a collection of mismatched furniture, chairs, two end tables, couch, a sewing machine, and a credenza with a faux marble top, all pushed to the outside walls. All the drawers and cabinets were empty. On one of the tables there was an old-fashioned princess phone. I picked up the handset and listened for a dial tone. The line was dead. How long was she a tenant? A little over 2 years. You put an ad in the paper? We tried that, but had no response. So we staked a for-rent sign in the yard, and she came knocking on my door, asking to see the place. My husband and I bought these two properties at the same time, thinking one of our kids would move in. When that didn't work out, we decided to offer it for rent, so we'd have money coming in. This end of town, we don't get many prospects, so I was happy to show her around. I told her we'd waive the cleaning fee as long as she didn't have pets. Did she fill out a rental agreement? No need. She paid me cash. 6 months in advance. Took out her wallet, counted the bills, and put them in my hand. You must have been delighted. I was. Most of all, I liked the idea of someone living close by. We only have the one car, and I was hoping she'd drive me into town now and then. I didn't realize how seldom she'd be home, though home is probably not the right term. She traveled a lot, and only wanted the use of the place when she was in the area. How often was that? Every other Saturday. In the absence of a dining room, the living room had been called into service, the center taken up with a harvest table big enough to seat 10. The room smelled of pine-scented cleaning product. I leaned closer to the tabletop, peering at a slant so the light washed over the surface. No smudges and no fingerprints. That was interesting. I flicked a switch, and the overhead light came on. I got down on my hands and knees and did an eyeball scan of the floor. By the table leg, I found a 3-inch T-shaped length of clear plastic, not much thicker than a thread. I held it up so Vivian could see. Know what this is? Looks like a piece of plastic used to secure the price tags on items of clothing. Exactly, I said. I put it in my pocket. Under the table leg, I found a second one that I added to the first. I continued to search, quizzing her as questions occurred to me. The kitchen was immaculate. Counters and windowsills were spotless. Marvin had said Audrey was a neatnik, but when had she had time to scrub the place down? The refrigerator was empty except for the standard items. Tabasco sauce, mustard, ketchup, olives, and mayonnaise which were stashed in the door. The stovetop had been scoured with an SOS pad, judging from the residue of blue foam and a few stray fibers of steel wool. The flip-top trash can was lined with a brown paper bag. At the bottom, I found a crusty cleaning rag, gray with dirt and smelling of the same pine scent that permeated the rest of the house. Under the rag, I found remnants of two SOS pads reduced to nubs. I'm sometimes a whiz when it comes to clues. "Did she have visitors?" I asked. "I'm sure she did. Twice a month, I saw a van pull in a short time after she arrived. She'd go around and open the garage and have the driver pull into the garage. If visitors went in and out the back door, I wouldn't have seen them from my house. There was also a white panel truck over there at the same time." "Quite a crowd," I said. "Night she was here and the lights were on, she made a point of closing the Venetian blinds. Guess she didn't want you peeping in." "No danger of that. Rafe and I are usually in bed by 10. She was a night owl. Sometimes I'd see lights burning into the wee hours. I don't sleep well, which means I'm up 2 or 3 times. Do you remember when she was here last?" "I'd say Sunday or Monday night, but that can't be right. According to the paper, she was found Sunday afternoon, so I must be mistaken." A survey of the under-the-counter cabinets revealed a stack of big cast-iron skillets and cheap 6-quart saucepans. In the upper cabinets, there were numerous tumblers and 2 sets of melamine dinnerware. One drawer was packed with a jumble of kitchen utensils, and another held assorted flatware. There was no dishwasher and no disposal, but I found an adequate supply of dish soap in the squirt bottle under the sink. While the shelves in the reach-in pantry were bare, numerous sticky circles on the otherwise clean surface suggested the recent presence of industrial-sized canned goods. For a woman who didn't cook or entertain, Audrey had been prepared to feed the multitudes. What happened when the first 6 months' rent were up? She stopped by one afternoon and paid for the next 6. "Always in cash?" She nodded. "I suppose I should have asked her about it, but it really wasn't any of my business. At least I didn't have to worry about a check not clearing." "Didn't you wonder why she carried so much cash?" "I can guess what you're getting at. You think she might have been dealing drugs. I read the papers like everyone else, and I know about meth labs and marijuana farms. If I thought she was doing something illegal, I'd have called the police." "Good for you. Sometimes people get so busy minding their own business, they forget to do what's right." I went into the bedroom, which was crudely outfitted with a full-size mattress, 2 pillows, and a pile of blankets neatly folded at the foot of the bed. The closet was empty, not even 1 wire hanger left on the rod. I closed my eyes and drew in a breath. The lingering scent of White Shoulders cologne was unmistakable. I made 2 more circuits of the room, talking to Vivian over my shoulder. "Let me know if you see something I've missed." By then, the idea of finding her address book seemed laughable, since there were no personal items at all. I was satisfied I'd seen everything, though I hadn't dug up the dead flower beds or tapped my way around the walls in search of secret panels. I scribbled Marvin's address on the back of a 2nd card. "This is her fiancé's address. If mail comes for her, could you forward it to him?" "I don't see why not." "You want me to lock up?" "No point. I'll have the locks changed as soon as I can get someone out. No telling who else has a key." She walked me out to my car. I said, "I appreciate your being so nice about this. I don't want to protect the woman if what she did was against the law." I'll admit I was a bit uneasy, which is why I kept an eye on her. I couldn't put my finger on what was wrong, and when it came right down to it, I didn't have anything concrete to report. "Understood. You can't call the police because someone's drawing the blinds," I said. "When your husband comes home, would you ask if he has anything to add?" "I'll ask, but he won't be much help. I was the one who dealt with Audrey. She was a nice woman, by the way. I thought her schedule was odd, but aside from that, I had no quarrel with her." "My client's in the same boat," I said. If you think of anything else, would you give me a call? My office number's on my card, and my home phone's on the back. Of course. I hope you'll let me know what you learn. I'll do that. And thanks for your help. I returned to my car and fired up the engine. I pulled out of the cul-de-sac and turned right on Edna Road. I kept an eye on the rear-view mirror, and once I was out of sight of the house, I pulled onto the berm and took the pack of index cards from my shoulder bag. I wrote down what I'd learned, which didn't amount to much. Audrey Vance was a cipher, and as such, she was getting on my nerves. When I finished making notes, I put the car in gear and returned to the 101, arriving in Santa Teresa at 1:05. While the trip felt like a waste of time, I didn't write it off altogether. Sometimes coming up with nothing is a form of information in itself. I stopped by Marvin's on my way through town, hoping he'd be home. He answered my knock with a paper napkin tucked under his chin. He removed the napkin and crumpled it in one hand. "This is a nice surprise. I didn't expect to see you so soon." "I'm interrupting your lunch." "Not at all. Come on in." I wondered if you'd had a chance to scare up the old phone bills. "I pulled the file. Have you had lunch?" "I'll grab something on my way back to the office." "You should have a bite to eat. I made a big pot of soup. Chicken noodle with lots of fresh vegetables thrown in. I vary the soup from week to week depending on what looks good at the farmer's market. We can talk in the kitchen." "A man of talent," I remarked. "I'd reserve judgment if I were you." I waited while he closed the front door, then followed him into the kitchen with its bright yellow breakfast nook. He turned the gas up under the 6-quart stock pot and took a bowl from the cabinet. "Have a seat. You want something to drink?" "Tap water's fine." "I'll take care of it. You sit and relax." He put ice in a glass and filled it at the kitchen sink. He took out a paper napkin and a soup spoon, then ladled soup into a bowl which he carried gingerly from the stove with a shy smile. He seemed happy to have company. In the center of the table, he put a jumble of wildflowers in a jar, and I had the sudden sense of what a nurturing man he was. I felt badly about Audrey's deceit. He deserved better. The soup was rich and dense. "This is wonderful," I said.
"Thanks. It's a specialty of mine, just about the only one I have."
"Well, it's a good one," I said. "Do you bake?"
"Biscuits, but that's it."
"I'll have to introduce you to my landlord, Henry. He's William's younger brother. I suspect the two of you would have lots to talk about." When I'd eaten, Marvin insisted that I sit while he washed the dishes and set them in the rack. I filled him in on my visit to Audrey's house in San Luis. "You could have made the trip yourself," I said. "I know you were worried about the impact, but there were no surprises. The place was bare."
"Was it nice?"
"Nice? No, it was a dump. Small wonder Audrey liked living with you."
"What about an address book? Any sign of it?"
"There was nothing personal at all."
"That seems odd," he said.
"Hang on a minute and I'll go get the phone bills." He left the kitchen and returned moments later with a file folder that he placed on the table in front of me.
"I hope you don't mind, but I went over them myself. This past month she made 2 calls to Los Angeles, 3 to Corpus Christi, Texas, and 1 to Miami, Florida. Same thing in January and February. If there were other calls, they must have been in the 805 area code."
Too bad." I ran an eye down the list of numbers. Marvin had put a check mark beside calls he ascribed to her. "Have you tried calling these?" I asked.
"I thought I'd leave it to you. I'm not that good at thinking on my feet. I get rattled and no telling what I'd blurt out. You want to use my phone?"
"Sure, as long as I'm here."
"Have at it," he said, indicating the wall-mounted phone. I stood and reached for the handset, tucking it between my shoulder and my ear.
I held the phone bill with my thumb close to the first mark he'd made. I punched in a number in the 213 area code. After 3 rings, I was treated to an ear-splitting screech, followed by a mechanical voice telling me the number was a disconnect.
"If you feel you have received this recording in error, please hang up. Check the number and dial again."
"Disconnect," I said. I tried the number again with the same results. The second Los Angeles number was also no longer in service. I dutifully tried a second time to be sure I was dialing correctly. Same dead end. "This is informative," I said. I zeroed in on the Miami call and punched in those numbers. When the screeching began again, I held out the handset so Marvin could hear. The number in Corpus Christi rang 22 times by my count, but no one answered. I hung up and sat down again, putting my chin in my hand. "So, now what?" he asked. "I'm not sure. Let me think about it for a minute." He shrugged. "The way I see it, we've got nothing."
"Shh.
Sorry." Marvin returned to his seat. He was on the verge of saying something else, but I held up a hand like an auditory traffic cop. In my mind, I was running through index cards in rapid succession. We still had no address book and no appointment calendar. The numbers she'd called in the past few months were useless at this point. If I'd had access to Polk directories for Corpus Christi or Miami, I might have been able to backtrack from the phone numbers to the relevant street addresses. Checking those addresses, even if I had them, would have meant making the trip myself or hiring private investigators in Texas and Florida to cover the job for me. Both options were expensive and might not have netted us anything. If the phones had been shut down, the target locations had probably been shut down as well. This is what I knew. Audrey had reason to spend the night in San Luis Obispo on an average of twice a month. During her stays, she made use of a house in an isolated area where, with the exception of her neighbor, her privacy was guaranteed. What she did in that house entailed the use of a table big enough to seat 10, a pantry full of oversized canned goods, and skillets and saucepans sufficient to feed any number of visitors. Vivian Hewitt said she'd seen a van and a white panel truck pull into Audrey's drive from time to time, but she'd never seen anyone going into Audrey's house. This suggested that her visitors came and went by way of the back door, which wasn't visible from her neighbor's vantage point. Vivian had also told me that on nights when the lights were on late, Audrey made a point of closing her Venetian blinds. I'd thought at first Audrey was the one busy covering her tracks. The problem was, she'd been dead since Sunday, and I didn't see how she could have done such a thorough job in the brief period between her arrest and her going off the bridge. This was Thursday, and the house in San Luis had been stripped of personal items and all of the surfaces wiped down. When had she found the time? Vivian Hewitt claimed someone had been there Sunday or Monday night. Clearly, it wasn't Audrey. I looked down at the phone bill. Of four phone numbers she'd called, three had been disconnected. Someone was sweeping up in the wake of her death, shutting down all the links, eradicating evidence. The only thing I'd spied with my little eye were the two snippets of clear plastic. I met Marvin's gaze. He said, "What?" "I did find these." I held up a finger, alerting him to my find while I slid a hand into my pocket and pulled out the two clear plastic stems. "What do these look like to you?"
"The little doodads they used to secure price tags to clothes in department stores."
"Right. You know what I think was going on? Twice a month, Audrey met with her crew and sat around the table, clipping tags out of all the garments they'd stolen. I don't know what happened to the goods afterward or what happened to the crew. But once she died, someone got busy dismantling the operation."
"So, now what?"
"I think I started in the wrong place. There's no point investigating Audrey. She's gone. It's the younger woman we need. I'm still mad at myself for not catching her license plate."
"Yeah, too bad you don't have a time machine. You could whiz back to the parking garage and take another look."
I felt a small mental jolt. My mouth didn't actually drop open, but that was the sensation I experienced.
"Oh, wow. Thanks for saying that."
I just came up with an idea. Chapter 14. Dante. Late Thursday afternoon, Dante finally caught up with his brother. When he left the office, Tommaso and Hubert were waiting in the parking garage, the limousine idling. As he emerged from the elevator, Cappy came around the corner, apparently on his way up. Dante saw him first, and he was already in motion when Cappy realized what was coming down. He stumbled backward, arms flailing as he tried to put himself beyond Dante's reach. He pivoted, and he'd made it four steps when Dante tackled him from behind, both men going down with a grunt. Dante scrambled to right himself and grabbed Cappy by the front of the shirt. He hauled him to his feet in one move and jammed him against the wall. Both were breathing hard, Cappy trying to loosen Dante's grip. Dante had 50 pounds on his younger brother, and even with the age difference, he was in far better shape. Dante's breath came hoarsely as he tightened his hold, twisting one hand over the other so Cappy's shirt collar formed a ligature. He could hear a momentary singing in Cappy's throat, and then there wasn't air enough for any sound at all. Dante had lost touch with his rage, and consequently had lost touch with his power. The feeling was familiar, immediate, and all-encompassing. He poured all of his energy into his hands until Cappy's eyes bulged, his face engorged in hot pink. Sweat seeped through his pores, and Dante was happy. His bodyguard, Hubert, had appeared at his shoulder. He'd stopped in his tracks, taking in the situation. He did a quick scan of the area to assure himself no pedestrians were close enough to see what was going on. If anyone had noticed, one look at the 300-pound bodyguard would have discouraged intervention. That was Hubert's job, discouraging others from interfering with his boss, no matter what he did. Dante knew if he'd chosen to go on until Cappy's legs folded and he sank his dead weight, Hubert would have shrugged and had Tommaso get out of the limo so they could load the body in the trunk. Dante knew he would have done it without a word of reproof. The simple presence of the man restored his self-control. Dante loosened his stranglehold, giving Cappy access to air. He kept his face close to Cappy's, even though the kid's nose was running and his breath was tainted with fear. "Listen, you dumb fuck. Do you have any idea how much damage you've done?" Cappy grasped his brother's wrist and pried his fingers away from his throat. Dante released him suddenly, shoving him hard against the wall. Cappy bent over and sucked in air, shaking his head. "She agreed to a deal. She was rolling over on us." Dante leaned close. "You don't pull shit like that, you asshole." "Audrey wouldn't turn on me. Never." "Wrong. You're wrong." Cappy kept a hand on his throat, close to weeping. "They came down on her. They scared the shit out of her, and she caved." "Who did?" "Some cop. I don't know his name. All I know is she broke down and agreed to tell him everything. She'd have done it right then, only her boyfriend came through with the bail, so they had to let her go. She'd set up a meeting with the DA first thing Monday." "You're full of shit. You don't step in. You don't take it on yourself. Nothing. Not anything. You get that?" "Pop backed me. I told him, and he said to do what needed to be done." Dante hesitated. "What are you talking about? You told Pop?" "I did. Ask him. I got word and went straight to him. He said take care of it. You weren't here, and someone had to shut the bitch down." "Pop said?" "I swear, I wouldn't have done it without him. What the hell were we supposed to do? She'd have ratted us out. You do anything like that again, I'll kick you to death. Now keep away from me." Dante pushed Cappy toward the elevator, kicking him hard in the ass as a fare-thee-well. In the limo, he leaned back against the seat and closed his eyes. The smackdown was pointless. Dante knew his brother would run straight to Pop and whine about mistreatment. What felt good in the moment would just come back and bite him in the butt. His only hope was to get to his father before Cappy did. A matter of who could tattle first. Absurd for a man his age. He put the incident out of his mind. He had other issues to worry about. He'd had lunch with his sister Talia that day, and he'd broached the subject of Lola.
I've been thinking I'd ask her to marry me.
Well, that's a cheery prospect.
I can do without the sarcasm.
I'm telling you because you're one of the few people I trust.
Sorry, I thought you were joking.
I'm not. We've been talking about it, and it's not such a bad idea.
I don't get it. It's been 8 years. Why marry her now?
She wants a kid.
She wants a child?
What's wrong with that?
Talia laughed. Dante closed his eyes, shaking his head.
Don't do this. Don't turn this into a fight. Say what you want. That's why I brought it up. Just don't be a bitch about it.
Fine. You're right. Let me take a deep breath and we'll start again. Nothing accusatory. I'll ask questions, okay?
Fine.
How's she going to handle the pregnancy?
Like every other woman, I guess.
Not like other women. She's a head case. I don't mean this as criticism. I'm stating a fact. She's obsessed with her body and nutty about her weight. That's why she smokes, to keep the pounds off.
She says she'll quit. She's also cut back on alcohol, a glass of wine a day, and that's it.
Because she's worried about the calories, which is why she does drugs.
She doesn't do drugs. Would you listen to yourself? She's dead set against drugs.
Except for appetite suppressants. Have you looked at her lately? She's skeletal. She has an eating disorder.
She had an eating disorder, but that's done. She saw Dr. Friedkin for a year, and she's fine.
He's not doctor anything. He's not even a licensed clinical psychologist. He's a psychic nutritionist, a quack.
He helped her. She's better.
She eats like a normal person. And then goes in the bathroom and sticks a finger down her throat. Pregnant women get fat. It's a fact of life. She'll go off the deep end.
Not all pregnant women get fat. You didn't.
I gained 40 pounds. Talia reached out and gripped his hand. Dante, you know I love you more than life itself, so please let me speak from the heart. Lola's a narcissist. She's moody and insecure. All she thinks about is herself. How could she possibly make room for a child?
They changed the subject at that point, since neither of them trusted themselves to go on. The question she'd posed was a bothersome one that he was still pondering. He caught his father after dinner when he was sitting out on the veranda smoking a cigar. Dante had always associated the smell of cigar smoke with Pop. There was a time when Lorenzo Sr. had smoked in the house. He considered this his due. The living room drapes and the upholstered furniture had been saturated with smoke, the ceiling pale gold with nicotine, windows clouded with the residue. When Dante moved his father into the big house, he insisted Pop confine his smoking to one of the outdoor patios. The old man was 83, and far less imposing than he'd been in the days when Dante was routinely pounded to a pulp. The punches and kicks were meant to keep him in line, or so his father said. Now he couldn't get over how small his father was, like a miniature adult, his cheeks lined and sunken, his nose and ears out of proportion to the size of his face. His hairline had receded in the shape of a heart, a V of gray in the middle of his forehead with a balding arc on either side. Dante sat down facing him.
You heard about Audrey?
I hope you're not here to complain.
Matter of fact, I am. I can't have Cappy pulling shit like that.
Hey, bub, you were gone. He came to me with a problem. His solution made sense. He knew you'd never go for it. You're too busy playing boss man and pissing on his shoes. Besides which, you're off on some mountain and no one could get hold of you. They have phone service in Canada. You could have called any time. Says you. Someone had to step up to the plate.
Pop, I've known Audrey years. She wouldn't have turned on us. I can guarantee.
That's not what Cappy heard. Word on the grapevine, she was rolling over on us. I told him to take care of it.
Pop and Cappy had used the same phrase, rolling over on us. Dante wasn't sure who'd come up with it first.
I don't get where you're coming from. You tell him to take care of it, and he goes out and whacks a valuable employee. That doesn't seem right. Does it seem right to you?
That might have been a bad call. I won't argue the point. You delegate responsibility, you can't come along after and second-guess what went down.
I didn't delegate anything. You did that. I can't have you undermining my authority.
What authority? Anything you have, I gave you.
That's right. I run the operation. He doesn't know the first thing about business.
So, you teach him.
I tried. He has the attention span of a gnat.
He says you're condescending. He says you belittle him.
That's bullshit.
Don't argue the point with me. I'm just telling you what he says.
And I'm telling you, he's not cut out for this. I promote from within the company based on merit and seniority. He's sitting on a felony conviction. How does that look?
You've been accused of a thing or two yourself.
All the more reason to keep the lid on.
You're the strong one. You've had all the advantages. Your brother wasn't as lucky.
Dante tried to bite back his response.
Anytime his father was losing an argument, he shifted to this old saw.
Dante couldn't help himself this time. He said, "He wasn't as lucky about what?"
"Your mother ran off and left him."
"Jesus. You know what? She ran off and left me, too. I don't see you cutting me any slack. Just the opposite. I gotta carry Cappy on my back whether I like it or not.
Now that's the kind of selfish attitude I'm talking about. He can't help what happened to him. He was a little kid. What she did crushed his spirit. He's never gotten over it. So he's touchy, you know, because she ripped his heart out. He's had a tough row to hoe, which you were spared."
"I was spared?
News to me. How so?" "You never said a word about her. Name one question you ever came to me with after she walked out. Every day Cappy asked for her, and every day he bawled his eyes out. You never shed a tear."
"Because you told me to buck up."
"That's right. 12 years old, it's time to get a grip. You knew when she left it had nothing to do with you. Cappy was 4, and what's he supposed to think? 1 minute she's there, the next minute she's gone. He's never been the same. I have 4 sisters who turned out all right.
How come they're okay, but not him? And what about me?"
"Even then, you knew better. Women are like that. About the time you think you can count on them, they take off without a word. She didn't even leave a note."
"So, Cappy's a loser, and everything goes back to that. He gets a free ride off that one event. I should be so lucky."
"You watch your mouth. You be careful what you wish for."
"Forget it." Dante got up. He had to get away from the old man before he blew his stack. His father stirred with agitation, his tone peevish.
"Where's Amo?"
Dante stared down at him, caught off guard.
"Amo? I haven't seen him since breakfast. He wants me to take him shooting. I said we'd go up to the firing range and get in some target practice."
"Amo's been dead 40 years.
"He's upstairs. I told him to find Donatello and come down here, the both of them."
Dante hesitated. "I thought you said Donatello didn't like to shoot."
"He'll get used to it. Make a man out of him. You know him. Wherever his brother goes, he's right behind."
Dante said, "Sure, Pop. If I see either one of them, I'll let him know you're waiting.
And tell him I don't have all day. Damn inconsiderate if you ask me."
Dante went into the library and poured himself a bourbon. Maybe the slip was momentary. His father was sometimes confused, especially late in the day. He'd forget a conversation they'd had 15 minutes before. Dante had written it off, thinking the mental stumbling was a side effect of his being tired or out of sorts. It was possible he'd suffered a small stroke. Dante would have to find a pretext for bringing a doctor in to check him out. His father had no tolerance for sickness or infirmity.
He'd never admit he might be subject to weakness of any kind. Dante carried his drink into the kitchen, where Sophie was cleaning up the dinner dishes, loading plates into the machine. "You seen Lola?"
"An hour ago. She was in workout clothes.